Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. A man who has made outsized contributions to that war, most especially during some of its previous phases, notably the Cold War at sea, is our guest for this full hour. I'm very pleased to say he is John Lehman, former Secretary of the Navy under President Reagan for 6 years. He is, among other things, the author of a brand new book entitled Oceans Ventured, Winning the Cold War at Sea. He is also a man who has, in his spare time, contributed to some of the other important challenges of our time, notably serving as a member of the 9/11 Commission, where he helped unravel what happened on that occasion and what we should be doing in terms of American policy thereafter. We may get to that if we have time, but we will spend most of it talking about some of his experiences with the Navy back in the day and looking at what our needs as a maritime power are in the present time. Dr. Lehman, it is good to have you with us, sir. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's good to be back with you.
Well, the pleasure is certainly ours. I thought we'd start, John, with the Reagan vision, as you saw it, for restoring America to the role that it had enjoyed, certainly post-World War II, as the dominant maritime power. Why was that important? And to what extent did that inform the Reagan strategy for, more broadly, challenging the Soviet Union?
Well, it's a very interesting story, and I would, you could begin it back in the Book of Genesis, but let's start with the lost effort of Ronald Reagan to get the Republican nomination in 1976. And that he ran on a platform that really was based on his vision that the U.S. and NATO and the West were losing the Cold War, and that the policies of the Ford administration, which were based on détente and reaching accommodation with the Soviets, was a losing strategy, a strategy that would never end the Cold War.
And this put him notably at odds with your former boss, Henry Kissinger, as I recall. That must have been a bit of a dodgy situation for you.
Well, Henry Kissinger is a fascinating person, as you well know. You know him well. He's a person who felt that it was necessary after the Vietnam trauma and most of all the Watergate that followed it, which utterly destroyed the power of the presidency, if only temporarily. And he believed his job was to make the best of a very, very difficult situation that U.S. power had been absolutely paralyzed by the Watergate Congress and the belief that we were overextended and had to cut defense and had to completely adopt a different strategy than had been traditional during the Cold War. So without spending too much time on Henry's view, he was by no means against rebuilding American forces, but he also believed that to gain time, it was necessary to make accommodating agreements with the Soviet Union, like the SALT II agreements. And there, he differed very much from Ronald Reagan. Reagan's view of the Cold War was best expressed the year after he lost when he was interviewed and asked, well, what would his strategy be in the Cold War? How did he view the Cold War? And he replied, it's very simple. My Cold War strategy is we win, they lose. And that was not just a rhetorical flourish. That really reflected his approach.
So you have said in the book that you had a vision, you and he obviously, that in order for us to win once again, we not only had to reestablish ourselves as a superpower, but that being the preeminent, the dominant, I think is the word you use, maritime power was essential to that status. Is that right?
That's quite right. He came to understand that NATO had slipped into a very negative defeatist attitude towards the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union had 180 divisions on active duty along the Central Front, and the most NATO could mount in peacetime was 40 divisions. And so it was a huge overbearance of power on the landmass of Europe. And NATO became more and more obsessed with this. And in the 60s, the policy of flexible response was adopted, which Reagan did not believe was at all credible. And that was, well, okay, de facto, we were not going to be able to stop this. So the Warsaw Pact, 180 divisions from sweeping all the way to the English Channel, we had to stop that through the use of tactical nuclear weapons if they came too far. Well, this was an inherently unbelievable strategy because it meant launching, if the Soviets felt strong enough to move in a conventional fashion, that we would answer that with nuclear weapons. And that really was not a very believable scenario.
So, particularly, perhaps, on Western European allied soil.
Well, exactly. But the Russians, particularly, were... they did not believe there was any fire break between tactical nuclear weapons and strategic nuclear weapons, and quite understandably, because those weapons would be landing actually on Western Soviet soil, to say the least. And so they did not believe there was a fire break. And so that was the problem was that Reagan came to understand that geopolitics gave inherently NATO the upper hand on the military balance. All they had to do was recognize it. Geography is enormously determining in military balances, and NATO owned the seas. The Soviet Union and the Warsaw Pact were landlocked. Most of their land was north of the 50th parallel, which meant that they had no really good agricultural land. The West had the resources. The West had far greater economic strength. And yet here they were having to make concessions and accept the Brezhnev Doctrine. And you recall all of the academics were talking about convergence. They had big advantages economically and in medical care, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. John, we have to pause for just a second. When we come back, I want to pick up on this idea that we had the advantage at sea, and yet that was a geographic rather than an actual one at the time. And then we'll get into what you and he, President Reagan, did to try to remedy the situation you found when you took office as Secretary of the Navy. We're talking with John Layman, the author of a brand new and very important book, Oceans Ventured, Winning the Cold War at Sea. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by John Layman, the former and very distinguished Secretary of the Navy. He is an accomplished author, among other things, with several books to his credit, including On Seas of Glory, Command of the Seas, Making War, and now Oceans Ventured, Winning the Cold War. We're talking about this memoir of his experiences and insights for our own time that we can draw from what President Ronald Reagan, with whom we both had the privilege of serving, did to restore America as the dominant maritime power and thereby underpin its role as the world's preeminent superpower. John, we're talking about a sea change, I guess it's fair to call it, very literally, in what the policy approach had been. Let's talk about what the sort of specific actions that were taken by President Reagan upon successfully winning office in 1980 on a platform, as you say, really of peace through strength and we win, they lose. What did he do with respect in the first instance to adopting a new maritime strategy that basically directed everything else that we'll talk about in a moment?
Leading up to the 1980 election, he spent a lot of time thinking about strategy. He, unlike many presidents, unfortunately, Ronald Reagan had a very good strategic instinct. And so he consulted many people. And to make a long story short, he adopted a peace through strength strategy that was costed out and that was very detailed in its planning and heavily emphasized rebuilding the United States Navy and encouraging the Europeans to do the same with their navies to reassert maritime supremacy. In the years prior to his election, the Navy was actually forbidden to use the term maritime superiority or maritime supremacy. It was told to use the word sufficiency, as the previous administration slashed the Navy budget, cut the Navy from almost 800 ships at the beginning of the Vietnam War down to about 415 ships. So Reagan came through with a strategy. We are going to rebuild the Navy. We need a minimum of 600 ships and 15 carrier battle groups. He decided we would reactivate the four almost brand new post-World War II battleships and proceed with funding R&D and readiness so that we could make it clear to the Soviets that they would lose an encounter. They would be absolutely devastated at sea. And because of that, they would ultimately lose in the Central Front as well. So that is what deterrence is all about, to dissuade your enemy from thinking that they can gain advantage by attacking. And that was Reagan's strategy, to make it clear to them they couldn't.
And it was one thing to enunciate a strategy, but there had to be, you know, actual facts, I guess you can't say on the ground, but at sea, that would back it up. And you've mentioned the force structure that he sought, a 600-ship Navy and 15 carrier battle groups, re-upping and putting to sea once again these battleships. This buildup was extraordinary and required a revitalization of our defense industry and the churning out at a pace we hadn't seen in many years, ships to fill out the fleet in order to do that strategy. And I'm struck by the fact that we're still living off the investment you all made to a very considerable degree, are we not?
Well, we are, unfortunately, but I think that is changing. So, to understand the buildup, where we more than doubled shipbuilding, we more than doubled readiness, which is the training money and sustainability money. We also doubled the R&D accounts, and we started buying the technology, which was our great advantage. And that was only made possible with what was about a 15% increase in the defense budget, because along with it, Reagan was a true believer in free enterprise and in competition. And so the Pentagon's philosophy, led by Cap Weinberger and all of the service secretaries, was to bring competition back, not these fake phony beauty contests where you award a monopoly for 30 years, but where you have competition every year. We have two sources for every missile, and you compete. The low-cost bidder with the highest quality won the biggest, and the highest price one ended up having the smaller. But and it worked. We brought the prices down. We returned $8 billion to the Treasury for cost underruns in shipbuilding. That had not been done before, and it certainly hasn't been done since.
Well, I was just thinking that one of the really sorry legacies of the Clinton years was the decision made by Les Aspin, the Secretary of Defense, who, as I recall, early on in his tenure, pulled in all of the defense industry leaders and said, listen, there's just not going to be enough money to keep you all going. You have to consolidate. And the option, John Layman, I guess, is that to have the kind of competition that you talked about went over the side along with that consolidation, did it?
Well, you hit on a very important point. The real consolidation came after the Cold War ended and when the Berlin Wall fell and the defense budget was cut 40%, which was deeper than it should have been. But certainly we could have and should have cut the defense budget then because the Soviet Union had collapsed. It was then that the Defense Department made the decision in the Clinton years to reduce the prime contractors. There were some 16 major prime contractors that you could compete against each other. They decided to pay the defense companies to consolidate and merge so that there were only five. And so today we have essentially five, or in some consideration six, oligopolists, basically. They're too few to really have continuing competition, and that's been a major, major problem, but it's one that can be dealt with.
And below them, at the prime levels, you've had a consolidation of suppliers, which is also a concern to me about the industrial base and our ability, particularly if we have to remedy, as I think Donald Trump is trying to do now, some of the shortfalls that have ensued from all of this. But before we get to all of that, John, let me just conclude this. You've mentioned restoring readiness, restoring investment in R&D, and bringing high technology to bear as key parts of the buildup and implementation of the strategy. I know that one other feature of your book, Oceans Ventured, indeed it takes its title from one of these other components of this incredibly important transformation. I guess if I were citing Barack Obama, it's a fundamental transformation of the United States Navy on your watch, was the use of exercises, both to test strategic and tactical steps that you were innovating and also to signal the Soviets what we were up to. Talk a bit about the importance of that in this maritime strategy of yours.
Well, that's a key dimension. During a meeting in the transition between the election and President Reagan's inauguration, President-elect Reagan asked, what can we do that we can show the Soviet Union? It's a new game in town. We have to make them understand that we are changing directions and there's nothing they can do to stop a reshifting of the balance to make it hopeless for them to think that they can win the Cold War or even continue it. And so basically we said, here's what we can do. Every year, the NATO navies have a huge set of exercises, but they were, for the previous 20 years, they were forbidden to go above the Greenland-Iceland-UK gap. In other words, to go north where the Soviet bases and vulnerabilities were, into the Norwegian Sea, the Barents Sea, in the Pacific, into the Bering Sea and the Arctic waters, which are a huge advantage if you can operate in them, but they're difficult to operate in them.
Essentially creating safe havens for them.
Yes. No, they had felt these were their home waters, and NATO had not really ventured up there in any large way for 20 years because a policy of detente prohibited it.
Which translated into pressure from the Soviets on Norway, for example, and I guess Japan and the Pacific as well, did it not?
Exactly. Very good point, because if you stay below what was called the GIUK gap, so as not to provoke the Soviets, you are de facto writing off the flanks, that is Norway and all of Scandinavia, and in the Mediterranean, the Eastern Med, Turkey and Greece, and in the Pacific, Japan. So this is a hopeless and defeatist strategy. So Reagan loved the idea. Well, what we did was say, look, we have an option. We can take this annual kind of meaningless exercise and rewrite the rules and go north unexpectedly by the Soviets. But we said this has to be a naval exercise. You can't, this can't go into the joint arena to be debated. It'll leak. It'll go, it will be debated for 5 or 10 years before anything's done.
You know the Pentagon too well, John Lehman.
Yeah, well, and President Reagan got it right away. So he agreed to let it be a Navy, a Marine, and to a degree an Air Force exercise, because we wanted and needed the Air Force long-range bombers equipped with anti-ship missiles. We wanted the F-15s up in the northern flank.
John, we have to pause. I apologize for the vicissitudes of the clock. We're going to come back and finish up the conversation about Oceans Ventured 81 and the insights both we took away from it and the Soviet Union did as well. Our guest is Secretary John Lehman, naval aviator himself, by the way, commander in the United States Navy Reserves, and a tremendously, now retired, of course, but a tremendously important figure in this period we're talking about. The subject of his book, Oceans Ventured, Winning the Cold War at Sea. We'll be right back with more.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're joined by John Lehman, the former Secretary of the Navy, a man whose role in that particular capacity, I think it's fair to say, was extraordinary. And much of it is captured in his new book, Oceans Ventured, Winning the Cold War at Sea. We are in the midway point of a very important hour-long conversation with John about his insights into the Navy's past, and we're about to talk about some of its future requirements. But before we do, I want to finish this conversation with you, John, about Ocean Venture 81, what we took away from that exercise and what message it did, in fact, convey powerfully to the Soviet Union.
First of all, we were able to select a very aggressive and hugely experienced strategic operator to put in command of the NATO strike fleet. And that was Admiral James Ace Lyons. And we put him in command of this exercise, which was basically to take that NATO fleet north suddenly and to go way up north, all the way up, operating in the Norwegian Sea and all the way up to the Barents Sea, and run aggressive training, proving to the Soviets that they couldn't stop us, that we could run. We did training strikes. I went up there on that exercise and flew A-6 missions right up to the border of Sweden and further north up to the Soviet border, and then pop up and make sure they know we're there. And in fact, the first time they realized that ACE had gotten 85 major combatants up into the Norwegian Sea in this exercise, when he sent a flight of 12 fighters 1,000 miles from the carrier to blow through a Soviet exercise that intelligence had told him was going on. And that was the first they knew we were up there, when these 12 fighters flew through their exercise at 550 knots. And it just blew their minds, because this had never happened before and what was going on. And so anyway, we did those exercises every year, patterned on Ocean Venture. And the purpose was to prove to the Soviets that they could not stop us, and that by not being able to stop us, they had a new vulnerable dimension in their whole defense that totally changed what they call the correlation of forces, that we could attack their most strategic areas from the sea, and not just in the Barents and the Norwegian Sea, but in the Pacific as well, up around Petropavlovsk and Vladivostok. And we did this every year. We changed and improved the exercises. Ultimately, we were able to put at least one carrier in the big fjords and operate the air wing in the fjords where they could not possibly find us, because the fjords are on either side, 3,000-foot mountains, and they could not get a radar pick on them. And that would allow us to operate right up against the Soviet border, and there's nothing they could do about it. And that change the balance.
I did want to come back to something you alluded to a moment ago, and that was the emphasis that you personally placed as the SecNav of both finding and promoting talented officers. Admiral Irons, as you well know, John Layman is a dear friend of both of ours and serves as the chairman of our military committee at the Center for Security Policy, among other things. He's a frequent guest here, and his insights and his experiences is an extraordinary asset to our team, needless to say. But do tell us a little bit about the role that he played in both thinking through and applying this maritime strategy of yours as an example of others you worked with as well in the Navy.
Well, Ace was a very experienced operator, very successful commander of destroyers and cruisers and had been chief of staff of a large battle group. But he was also a thinker. He was also a strategist. His sea tours were all done in strategic planning, and he was a great combination of a strategic thinker and an aggressive operator. He was kind of the Bull Halsey of the Cold War, or the George Patton, if you will, to mix services. He was always controversial. He was always a risk taker, but never an unthinking risk taker. They were calculated risks. And he knew how to operate the fleet to maximum effect. So after the successful totally changing the balance in the North Atlantic and the Norwegian Sea, he became Pacific Fleet Commander and did the same thing in the Pacific. So he was on active duty right up until shortly before the Berlin Wall fell. And we owe him a lot of credit for the successes. But we also had terrific chiefs of naval operations, that Jim Holloway before Reagan came in, and then Tom Hayward, aggressive aviator, and then Jim Watkins, who was a submariner and just as aggressive. So we were blessed with very good leadership, but of course it would have all been useless if it weren't for the leadership of President Reagan, who stood by and understood it and pushed it right to the end.
Well, I want to thank you for yours too, because I think to some extent those personnel choices made all the difference, and as did the maritime strategy that they were tasked with executing. So it's great to have a chance to visit with you about it. Let me switch gears, if I can, now to the challenges that the Navy and indeed the nation are facing today, John Layman. I'm thinking specifically at sea, but increasingly what is going to determine the balance of power or the ability to be the dominant maritime power will involve other capabilities as well, as you know. Let me start with Russia. There is a strategic force modernization underway, as I'm sure you're very well aware, in Russia, that had it happened during the Cold War, I think would have had us on red alert. And yet, with the exception of the effort that President Trump is making, commendable as it is, it's pretty modest to rebuild our nuclear posture at sea as well as ashore. We are really massively outpaced in terms of the programs and capabilities that the Russians are bringing to bear. I'm told that there may be as many as 22 different systems, missiles, ships, aircraft, cruise missiles, and the like, that are now part of, or shortly will be, part of a complete overhaul of the Russians' strategic modernization program. What are your thoughts on that, and how in particular it bears on the need for us to strengthen the Navy's capabilities to contend with at least the sea-based elements of those modernized efforts?
Well, you know, history doesn't repeat itself, but it can often rhyme, and it is certainly rhyming today with the period when President Reagan came into office. The Navy has suffered years of cuts and insufficient funding, the readiness. The fleet is less than half it was We had a 600 ship Navy, and now it's down 273. And yet we have more requirements. We now have three centers of power that are adversarial to us. You've got the Western Pacific, you've got the North Atlantic and the Mediterranean again, and you have the Middle East. And so we've been having to run these ships so hard that people are, just like in the 70s, people are bailing out the experienced technicians there. They've got plenty of job opportunities outside. We're not retaining as many of the best as we have to. And we are running the ships we have, to mix a metaphor, into the ground. They are not getting the maintenance they need. And so what has to be done is to restore deterrence. The reason we're seeing so much trouble around the world and the aggressiveness of Russia and in some ways China and Iran is that they perceive that we are now too weak to defend the principles and the freedom of the seas that we have been traditionally counted on to do. And so they feel it's much less risky to operate against the United States in politically and potentially militarily. So we've got to restore deterrence. That's what it's all about. And we can't overestimate and panic over what's going on. It's serious. But as John McCain always says, Russia is a gas station with an economy the size of Denmark. It is not the Soviet Union. However aggressive they want to be, they cannot afford to match our capabilities. And I must say, Mr. Putin is very effective in maximizing the political effect of what is a much tinier military capability than even we have today, as shrunken as ours has become. He's concentrated the spending on areas where our vulnerabilities are the greatest, on anti-submarine warfare. And he's been enabled to do this by a very, very effective cyber attack. They always depended on the U.S. to innovate, and they would then steal our missile design. In a way, it gave us another advantage, and they were always about 10 years behind us. And now they're not. They are able to, they penetrated virtually every one of our defense contractors, so they know exactly what we're doing. They've stolen a lot of the design and innovation, and they've been able to field it faster than we can, because while we have cut the size of all the forces, we have grown the size of the bureaucracy. The bureaucracy today in the Pentagon, there are 970,000 civilians, almost double what there were at the height of the Reagan years, and for less than half of the force. So we have to deal with that. We've got to cut the bureaucracy. We've got to reduce the overhead and reestablish deterrence.
Yeah. I want to come to China in a moment, because it's that's very much on our mind. And we have to take another break just quickly. But when we come back, maybe one further thought on Russia, then to China, and then what we need to do for the United States Navy in our concluding segment with Secretary of the Navy John Layman right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're visiting for this full hour with John Layman, who has graciously given his time to talk us through, among other things, his new book, Oceans Ventured, Winning the Cold War at Sea. And we've been discussing both what that entailed back in the day and what has happened to the Navy since, the challenges that have arisen. And I did want to ask you, Mr. Secretary, about one particular development by the Russians that hasn't gotten a whole lot of attention, but it strikes me as a new factor in a deterrence equation that is particularly challenging. And that is apparently a very high-speed, long-range, nuclear-powered strategic drone submarine, which is said to have a 100-megaton warhead on it, which, if used against a city or port on the coast of the United States, would be unquestionably absolutely devastating. How does something like that, to say nothing of these other capabilities that the Russians have been, as you say, managing to put into place despite a relatively small economy, factor into a deterrence equation as you see it? What do we do about it?
We have to be realistic about what the Soviet capabilities really are. They talk up a very big game, and I think it's having effect. But the reality behind that is that there are no systems that they have that we don't also have R&D programs, not necessarily deployed programs, but R&D programs. And in fact, most of what they have, they developed by stealing in cyber penetration and hacking into the R&D programs that we have in our contractors. And so the atomic submarine with the huge megaton warhead is a reality as a research program and development program. It is not on deployment at this time. And all of the other programs that he bragged about are in various stages of research and development. We have the same research and development capabilities, and certainly drone warfare and unmanned systems underwater, on the water, and over the water in the air are going to be increasingly found in our military and their military and the Chinese military. It makes a lot of sense. And artificial intelligence and the advances that are continuing in the technology world make this possible, and we are pursuing it.
Well, I hope you're right. My sense is that some of these things are farther along than R&D, but we'll be watching that closely. Let me turn to China, Mr. Secretary. The thing that is distinctive, it seems to me, about the Chinese threat that has emerged, perhaps, as you say, in part at least because of the perceived weakness of the United States, perhaps it's just part of their 100-year plan to emerge once again as the dominant power on the world. But it's not just the rather dramatic buildup of a blue water navy with a host of technologies. Again, I think you're right. They have been ripping us off as well, but some of it seems to be both adapted from and internally developed in terms of capabilities that could be a threat to us. But it's also the fact that they have increasingly been taking up positions to some extent in a sort of colonial operation. There's this so-called debt trap that they've been using to gain access to resources and in some cases ports and airfields overseas. But they've now been, of course, taking up these man-made and now fortified islands in the South China Sea. There's a base that could effectively give them similar kind of control in the North Indian Ocean out of Pakistan, Djibouti, the Seychelles, the Maldives, Panama, even perhaps the Azores. These are game-changing facts on the ground, in a sense, that I just wonder, how do they factor into the U.S. strategy, maritime and otherwise, of the future as you see it?
It's not a new development. The Chinese have not been quiet about this. It really, they started talking to us about this shortly after the end of the Cold War, when we disarmed, basically, and we withdrew from the Western Pacific. And the Chinese were at the time concerned that we were basically getting out of the Western Pacific. And they were very frank in the discussions with the U.S. Navy and with the U.S. government that they said, basically, why are you evacuating the Pacific? We are utterly dependent on the sea lanes for everything. And the Sunda Straits, the Straits of Malacca, and now the U.S. fleet is essentially gone. Why are you disarming? Because that means we're going to have to take your place. And they were quite open about it. And what we've helped to create is our own doing by slashing the American fleet from 600 ships to 240 some at its low point. We have invited other people and other powers to fill that vacuum that we created. So now we've got to reestablish. You know, again, we can't overestimate the nature of that threat. They intend to control the Western Pacific, And that has implications for us. And we've got to make it clear that while the fact is that if they choose to, they can be more powerful in that arena than we are.
Yeah, but I hope it's limited to that. That would be kind of the best case under the present circumstances. But it looks as though they're trying to get into other places as well. In addition to sort of the traditional assets that they're bringing to bear and a prodigious shipbuilding program, I'm told that there are some 7 carriers in the works that will be domestically manufactured, not imported from Russia. But in addition, Mr. Secretary, just very quickly and very generically, I guess, we've got anti-carrier ballistic missiles. We've got hypersonic and maneuvering weapons. We've got Chinese space control, as well as sort of their strategy of area anti-access area denial, that all seem now to be making vastly more challenging the job of our Navy and projecting power and maintaining the sea lines of communication and otherwise maintaining the peace in not just the Western Pacific, but elsewhere around the world. Could you just talk us through what the implications are of all of that for our own Navy today? We clearly need to fix readiness. You've mentioned that shipbuilding needs to be once again increased. But how do we deal with the complex of capabilities that these two nations, among others, are now mounting to us at sea and, for that matter, from space?
Well, it's a very important issue that you raised here. It's not a new one. The complexity of war at sea involving space, air superiority, surface warfare, and undersea warfare, it has always been hugely complex. If you look at it from the longer term, are we going to bet on inherent innovation and creativity and almost unstoppable technological development of our free enterprise system? Or are we going to believe that a centrally planned economy, which of course helped bring about the ruin of the Soviet system, which is becoming even more centralized in China, is in the long run going to be able to sustain a superiority over our technological development? That's the real challenge. And we have always, particularly in the Navy, been able to harness the innovation, the animal spirits of the American technological freedom that to keep us better than the opponents. There have been maneuvering ballistic missile warheads that the Soviets had during the Cold War. The Chinese have them today. There's nothing that is inherently, fundamentally changes the balance. It's the numbers and the training and the sheer size and willingness to use that naval power. And here we have a challenge. It's if we don't restore our naval power, then we are going to be excluded from the Western Pacific.
Yeah. Hey, let me just take advantage of the fact that I've got you on the eve of this quite interesting summit between President Trump and Kim Jong-un of North Korea to get your thoughts. If you had 30 seconds of advice for the president, what would it be?
I have always believed in Churchill's aphorism that it is always better to jaw, jaw, jaw than to war, war, war. But if you let the negotiating process become the end and the dominant consideration in a military balance, you end up where we are today. We fell into that trap twice before in negotiating with the North Koreans, and it is very likely to happen again unless the president realizes that this is their strategy.
John Lehman, we are hard out of time. This has been such an fascinating conversation and insightful on so many different levels. Congratulations again on Oceans Ventured, winning the Cold War at Sea. I appreciate so much your taking the time to visit with us about it, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.